my head. It wasn't so simple. Your father was threatening her, setting up trade embargoes. I sighed. War is never so simple as a single person's greed. His eyes were on me for a long time.
No,
he said.
And to be very honest, I don't know what changed. Calix wanted peace. He spent months convincing my father that he could end this war with the Islanders peacefully, if only he could negotiate. I think there was even talk of a marriage. Father granted him a fleet of new ships to negotiate peace. But within days, Calix had murdered every one of them he could find. And when he came back, he told everyone my father had issued the order. He convinced everyone my father was insane. And then Calix became king.
That makes no sense, I said, shaking my head. I started walking faster, like the motion could push my mind to work faster. How could he lie so completely? How could he petition for peace and then turn around and commit genocide?
Something changed,
Galen said.
I've just never known what it was, and he won't tell me. At this point, I'm not sure it matters.
Of course it matters, I snapped at him.
Why?
He demanded, keeping pace with me.
Is there anything that you could discover about those days that would change what happened, that would lessen the things he did?
I don't know, I returned. How do you live with it, knowing what he's done?
Because he was 18, and as far as I can tell, scared and foolish. It was a terrible act, but he's been a good king for years. He's protected me whenever I needed it.
He's a murderer, I snapped back. Galen stopped, his face flat, and I turned in a fury to meet his gaze.
So am I,
he said. This drew a sharp breath into my chest.
Me too,
Seth called brightly from a few feet away, though he didn't sound ashamed like Galen did. I scowled at him.
You're supposed to pretend you can't hear us, Seth,
Galen told him.
Right,
he said, nodding. Galen's throat worked.
Does taking a life make a man irredeemable in your eyes, Shalia?
There's a difference between taking a life and genocide. He shook his head.
There shouldn't be. A life is a life.
I don't think Calix would agree with you, I told him. And that's the difference. Galen's eyes swept around us as he grimaced.
It's getting dark,
he said.
We need to get back to the castles.
I looked up at them, looming ahead of us in the distance. The thought of Calix kissing me, touching me, it turned my stomach. Those hands had tortured my dearest friend. They had tied her up to watch her family burn, and Rian beside her.
Shalia.
I shook my head. I can't.
One decision doesn't make a man a monster,
he said.
You choose your fate with every decision, and he's listening to you, so help him make better decisions.
My eyes closed. I wanted to be more to a man than just something to improve him. But this was my fate. This marriage had been my choice, and there was no turning back.
You should tell him,
Galen said.
That you know. See what he says about it.
I opened my eyes, surprised. Telling him I know does not seem wise.
Everyone wants to know they can be loved, even in consideration of their most monstrous parts,
he said. I didn't voice it as we walked forward, but there was a flaw in Galen's logic. It would require me to love my husband, and I wasn't sure I could do that. Seemingly despite the churning recesses of my mind, it was a peaceful walk. The sun began its slow dive below the edge of the world, sending out lovely, desperate colors as it clung to its last moment. As we neared the castles, it made the three white structures look like some kind of deity indeed must live there, shrouded in the most beautiful colors of the world. As we rose on the royal causeway, the colors caught on the moving, shifting surface of the ocean. I stopped, staring at it. "Skies above," I breathed. We were high enough on the rise of the causeway that I could look out over the low parts of the city, and I could see people moving in the streets and the winding lines still trailing from the grain mill. The place was long closed, yet they stayed there, waiting for food. I looked back to the beauty of the three castles. Perhaps Galen was right. Perhaps the past couldn't possibly matter. Perhaps it was only this, the things that I could change for the future, helping to create a day when more people would live than die. Maybe that's all I could ever do. Maybe it was enough. Call to Service. Galen escorted me into the castle and to the large hall, but kissed my hand and told me he couldn't stay for the meal. He lingered for a long moment, like he wanted to say something else, but then he turned and left. I went into the hall alone. Calix wasn't there, and Danae and I sat on the raised dais. I saw Kairos, and when our eyes met, I looked to the hallway and back to him, and he nodded once, raising his wine to me. "Are you well?" I asked Danae. Her posture was straight and careful, her muscles tense like she was waiting for something. She leaned back, but she still seemed watchful.
"Yes."
"Court makes me... edgy." I nodded, taking a bite of stew that thankfully didn't seem to have fish in it. Her eyes swept over me. "And you? How are you finding the City of Three?" My shoulders lifted, unsure how to answer the question. There were so many things crowding my mind. I needed to ask Calix about his past, and I could only imagine it would be an ugly conversation. But I also wanted to do something about the grain mill that I had seen, and the nagging feeling that I could be doing far more as queen.
"Foreign, of course. But there are problems that plague all people."
"Oh?" she asked, turning slightly toward me.
"Hunger," I said. "Safety. The need to protect your children. Everyone does it in different ways, but the tri people and the clans are not so different."
Her eyebrows lifted.
"Are we not?"
"We know hunger well," I told her. "Not as much recently. My brother Aiden has become a tremendously skilled hunter, and it seems he could always make food appear for us. But as a nomadic people, we have few steady sources of food and water. The people here face hunger on a larger scale, of course."
Danae propped her chin in her palm and covered her mouth with her fingers, but she nodded.
"Yes."
"I wonder if I can help," I told her softly. "I wonder if I could ask Calix to allow the women to work in the mill, to work to feed their families."
She was very still for long moments, and then her eyes shifted over to me, and she rubbed her mouth before dropping her hands into her lap.
"It is an excellent thought," she said. "But it would not be Calix's decision.
The three-faced god must make such a declaration."
Her eyes met mine.
"How? How do I get a god to make a declaration?" I asked. "Is that something you can do?"
Her mouth twisted into something that was too bitter to be a smile.
"No, I cannot. Calix feels he alone is the true conduit for the god's voice.
But the call of the three-faced god, particularly a call to service, is very, very powerful," she said, raising her chin.
Drawing a breath, I nodded.
"How do these calls to service usually present themselves?" I asked her.
She waved a hand.
"They can come in many ways.
dreams, visions. But the most powerful is in response to a prayer, asking the god for an answer.
I nodded. And he will listen? I asked.
The god? She asked, and her smile lifted with amusement.
Or Calyx? Who is more important?
Calyx, she said, looking forward. And I cannot know his mind. But yes, he likes solutions. If it solves a problem, he may listen.
Curling my hands around the arms of the chair, I sat up straighter, feeling hope rush through me. I could do this. I could be the queen they needed. And in finding peace for this country, protect Rian and Kairos and all the desert clans.
As soon as I stood at the end of the meal, Kairos appeared, bowing to the dais.
Sister,
he greeted me.
Let me escort you back to your chambers.
I smiled.
Of course, I said, and took his offered arm. Good night, Danae.
Good night, my queen.
Kairos led me down the steps and out of the hall, and Zeph was waiting.
He inclined his head and let us go several feet in front of him. But I still didn't dare tell Kairos of what Calyx had let slip the night before until we were truly alone. Kairos filled my nervous silence with chatter, and when we got to my chamber, led me out onto the balcony as Zeph shut the door behind us.
Now, Kairos said, glancing around us on the empty balcony. What did you want to tell me?
I leaned closer to him. The king said that he has a spy in Rian's ranks. His name is Tassos.
He told you his name?
Kairos asked, narrowing his eyes.
Yes, I said. It was an accident. We were arguing.
Kairos shook his head slowly.
No, I don't think it was, little sister. The king is far too calculating to tell you something like that by accident. He's testing you, trying to see if you'll tell Rian. Or perhaps if I will.
But doesn't Rian need to know there's a spy in his camp?
Kairos crossed his arms.
I would hope Rian always assumes there's a spy in his camp and acts accordingly. It's what I would do. And it's the only way they keep the leader so well protected.
I watched my brother. Is the leader Kata? I breathed.
He considered it, but shook his head.
Doubtful. Whoever the leader is, they are exceedingly careful. Kata shares Rian's reckless streak, in my opinion.
Do you know who it is? His eyes flicked to me and away, and I gasped.
No, I'm not certain, he said quickly. I have my suspicions, but I can't share them, especially since they're unconfirmed, and not with you.
That stung. But I thought of my husband questioning me the night before, and I nodded. I understand. And I did.
I couldn't tell Kairos that Calyx had been the one to kill the islanders, and Kairos couldn't share this with me. Not only were we fighting to keep each other safe, but marriage had also fractured my loyalty.
You should probably go before my husband returns.
Kairos nodded with a sigh, kissing the top of my head before going back into my chamber and out.
Calyx didn't return soon.
I spent a long time on the balcony, thinking about my conversation with Galen and then Danae.
Calyx had been the one to murder the islanders. He had killed Kata's family. And he nearly killed Rian, who had been in the islands during the massacre.
I wanted to confront him about it. I wanted to tell him I knew, to demand an explanation. But more than that, I wanted to do something good. I wanted to do something meaningful. And I knew that if I could just make him see that it was an easy solution, I could get him to agree with me about the mill.
The sound of the door closing drew my attention, and I saw Calyx smiling at me.
I was trying to surprise you,
he said. I didn't stand from the bench, the one I liked, closest to the edge so I could see out over the strange and moving water.
He came to me, sitting on it,
tugging my chin to him, but I pulled away.
Wife?
He asked. I shook my head, still unsure, still hesitating between what I wanted to say.
Galen said things went well at the Eridium.
Yes, I said quietly.
You should go back there tomorrow. It's a good place for you to be seen.
No, I said, and then shook my head again, but this time I had made my decision. I saw the grain mill and the women and children waiting for food behind it. It's wrong, I said, looking at him. Those women who stand in line for days. This is not the life they want. He opened his mouth with a scowl, but I remembered what Dene had told me. They want to serve the god, I continued. They want to serve their country. The god has been trying to show us what he wants. He wants women to feed their families and serve, and I believe he wants me to lead them to it. Calix watched me suspiciously.
You wish to pound grain?
He asked. I looked at my hands. If I must. But I believe the three-faced god wants me to serve by helping women serve their country.
So you want women to work?
Yes.
And the three-faced god told you this?
He asked, his eyes narrowing. I drew a breath. I can't claim to know, I said. But this idea came to me when I thought of how I might serve.
But you don't believe in the three-faced god.
This stopped me. I didn't. Could I lie outright about such a thing? How else could I come by such an idea? I asked, my voice hushed. He scowled, standing.
I suppose that's true. The women work in the factories, and we pay them.
Paying the women would mean they have money to spend, and money for tax, I added.
The labor will not interfere with raising families,
he insisted. The children are meant to be at the Eridium anyway.
But if a woman is with child, she will not work,
he said.
It seemed a small concession.
Of course not. He drew a slow breath.
Very well, wife.
He walked inside, but I stayed on the balcony longer, looking out over the wild sea. I felt numb from the horror I had discovered. But I knew this was progress. This was something my mother would be proud of. But now I knew the terrible price of the crown on my head, and I couldn't forget that. And if I did, I feared it would mean sacrificing my humanity. Salvation. Calix didn't wear his uniform and declined a carriage as we walked out of the three castles. Both our guards and Adria flanked behind us. Some of the men obvious, in uniform and formation, and others not, hidden and watching. The morning was gray and cool, the clouds overhead making shapes in the air that my people believed could watch our actions. Calix held my hand in his as we walked down the causeway, and for a moment I imagined what we looked like, a young couple, hand in hand. Simple. But nothing was simple. He had selected my dress for the morning. He had orchestrated the whole event to be another display, another showing. He had selected how many guards were attending to us and where they would be. And it was easy for him. Immense calculations he did without thinking. We walked down the causeway, easily strolling the short distance to the grain mill. The few people in the streets followed us, watching like we were a spectacle, a dog that had learned to walk on its hind legs. Calix tugged my hand, bringing me into the guarded entrance of the grain mill. The men standing watch sprang to attention, opening gates without a word from my husband. Even before we entered the building, I felt the threads trembling just beyond my fingers, vibrating in time with the rumbling beneath my feet. Stone, I realized. They must be using stone to grind the grain, and the force of it called to me. My palm grew sweaty in Calix's, but I didn't pull away.
I drew a slow breath, asking my power not to react. I remembered Kata's warnings about having less control if I didn't practice it. But I couldn't do anything with my power here, not with Calyx, with everyone watching. When we entered, the low rumble stopped. There were fewer than 10 men working at large stone stations in a room that had space for more than 100. The men stared at us, and there was noise and movement as someone rushed from a room above, skittering down a stone staircase on the far wall.
"My king! My queen!"
he bleated as he came close. He was a round, balding man with bright red in his cheeks. He bowed and then bowed again and again.
"Stop,"
Calyx said, holding up a hand. The man straightened a little and backed away.
"Come with me, all of you,"
Calyx ordered, waving his hand once to the others in the room. They looked at one another, wondering, worried. But Calyx moved on, my hand still trapped in his. He went through the door and down a long stone hallway where light flooded in at the end. As we grew closer to the light, I could see the ragged lines of people waiting in the back. We appeared, and again everything froze. A moment later, the people who had waited so long for their grain fell back, afraid, desperate to get out of the reach or the sight of the king. The three people who were parceling out small bags of grain looked bewildered, and then they tumbled out of their chairs to bow before my husband and me. The people in lines took to this too, and everyone dropped to their knees.
"No,"
Calyx shouted, rushing down the steps to an old woman who couldn't bend enough to kneel. He touched her shoulder and called a guard over to help her as he came back up the steps.
"You do not need to humble yourselves further. The three-faced god has seen your humility, your dedication, and your fears. On this day, the three-faced god has seen fit to save you."
Was that it? It seemed another game of power.
Servants refusing to bow to him diminished his power, but here, with his pageant graciousness, the refusal to let an old woman bow made him seem greater than he was.
The woman was weak and frail, and the guard knelt on one knee so she could sit on the other, and she wavered against him. I went down the stairs to her, looking at Calyx. "My king," I called softly. Calyx looked at me. "This woman needs food and water, desperately." Something like pleasure flashed across his face, but he turned to the overseer.
"Food," he ordered, "and water. All you have and can procure. Now."
The overseer ran, and Calyx nodded at a guard who trotted after him.
"You will all be well,"
Calyx told her, and she nodded against the guard's chest.
"The three-faced god knows you wish nothing more than to serve your families, your country, your god,"
Calyx said.
"But how can you do that without food for your children? Is not nourishment one of the greatest things a woman is called to give?"
There were murmurs and nodding.
"We are a strong people, a prideful people. And to beg for grain, it breaks us,"
Calyx said, pressing his hand over his heart like he knew anything of hunger.
"The three-faced god has called for women to work, here, if you're willing, to feed their families, to provide grain and food for their countrymen. I ask not for your humiliation, but for your work. Who of you is willing to work for your pride and for your families?"
The women and children were silent, stunned and frightened. The guard came back with water, offering it to the old woman as I looked out. My breath caught in my chest. Calyx's face folded into a deep glower as no one moved. "I am my king," I called, stepping forward. Calyx raised an eyebrow, but his face lightened.
"My queen, you want for nothing. Surely you do not need to be pounding grain," he said.
But it wasn't reproachful.
He was still using his loud voice, his voice that spoke of pageantry and stagecraft.
I want for my people, I told him, my voice quiet. I want to serve the three-faced god.
I will, said another voice. If it pleases my king and my god.
I turned around, and another woman raised her hand. Some spoke, some nodded. More women agreed.
Calix held out his hand to me, beckoning me, and I walked up the stairs to him. He caught my hand and drew me close, bringing my knuckles up to his mouth to kiss.
My love, I will leave these people in your capable hands. The three-faced god is most pleased with your care.
I nodded, and Calix released my hand to stare at me for a moment, almost as if he cared for me in the way he claimed. And then his hand slid around my waist and he tugged me closer, kissing me. My body was stiff, unyielding, not expecting such a display, and unable to adapt before he let go of me. People were clapping behind us as he pulled me to his side, waving and smiling at them. And then he let me go, and he made his way through the mill and several guards followed him. I took a breath and turned to the overseer.
Very well, I said. Show us how to grind grain.
The stations were all large, flat, circular stones that were in stacks of two and as wide across as my outstretched arms. They had a basket beneath and a hole in the top stone, and the overseer and the more practiced men showed us how to pour grain in the hole in the top and then turn the top stone with a handle. The grain was ground between the two stones and came out the edges into the basket. The stones rumbled as they turned, and soon the floor was trembling, shuddering with the effort, in a way that felt almost joyous. The overseer also showed us curved stones with a shaped rock, where women could make the flour even more fine, something he had ceased to do when there weren't enough men. Quickly the women organized themselves, some porting grain and moving baskets, some turning stones, some packing it up when it was finished. Zeph and Adria both helped, the former far too delighted with the idea of pounding grain by hand, and the latter thoroughly distraught with the idea of her hands potentially revealing that she had done physical labor. I took my place at the second stage of grinding, my hands eager to touch the stone. I closed my eyes as I learned the motion of it, and running one stone over another felt like plucking the strings of an instrument. I felt the different hums deep in my bones, and when no one could hear me over the unyielding noise of grinding, I hummed back. But it wasn't just the imaginary strings of a non-existent instrument. There were strings there, tightly packed in the stone, vibrating with noise and life at my touch. My power was alive and strong, rushing around me as all the stones scraped against one another. The stone I was holding grew warm under my fingers, pushing against my hand, and I could feel the slight unevenness of it. The places where the curve of the stone didn't meet the curve of the bowl in perfect alignment. And it felt like a snag, a grating that was scratching inside my ears. Glancing around, I focused on the stone, revising the shape of it, like a blacksmith would sharpen a blade, pressing it to sit perfectly in the bowl. I moved the stone around the new curve, and it seemed like music, like playing my fingers across the threads had created the low, thrilling tune that resonated deep in my bones and shivered up my spine with delight. With each sweep and turn of the stone, the pleasure of it washed over me. This was a stunning gift, to be able to take the rough and uneven and perfect it, to improve what nature had given us. In my hands, every motion felt like hope.
My queen? I dropped the rock with a gasp. One of the women was there, nervous to ask me a question about distributing the grain, and I stepped away from the stone to help her, the warmth of it still making my fingers tingle. Fool! What was I thinking, using my power like that? It was hidden and small. But even the smallest suggestion of magic would get me killed with sure and swift finality. Even though Calix had left us to our task, How many minutes would the greedy overseer wait to turn me in if he suspected my power? How quickly would the Sepia guard betray their newborn loyalty to me? Shivering, I took up the cart full of bags of flour and wheeled it down the long hallway. There were still many more people there than could work in the mill, and I helped the men in the back hand it out as quickly as we could, far enough from the moving pieces of stone that the trembling power inside me was more like a murmur than a roar. Just before we ran out, Zeph came with his giant arms full of more bags. By the time the overseer rang a bell to signal the day was done, the sky was blushing dark. The line had been cut in half, and it seemed a small thing, but with a few days' work, there would be no line. Adria came to join me outside, looking at her hands, worrying a bit of skin between her finger and thumb. "I think I'm getting a blister," she said. "You'll know if you get a blister," I told her with a deep sigh. "We should start walking. Zeph?"
"Here, my queen,"
he said, emerging from the mill with a mighty stretch that caused mysterious parts of his anatomy to crack and pop. He gave a monstrous yawn that sounded like some kind of animal call, and then smiled.
"I like milling."
"Of course you like milling. It isn't difficult for you," Adria whined. His shoulders lifted.
"If I'm being honest, not much is difficult for me."
"Hiding is probably difficult for you," I told him with a smile. "And you probably sink like a stone in the water," Adria said, crossing her arms.
"I'm an excellent swimmer,"
he said defensively. "You must have been hit by a tree branch or two riding on a horse," I said. "You're so very tall." His brows knit together.
"Occasionally."
"What do you do when you have a wound?" Adria asked, a hint of a smile on her face. "There's no way you could hold a needle with your giant calloused hands."
"I rub some dirt in it and move on with my life," he grunted. "I don't like this conversation anymore."
Adria snorted. "You started it." Calix and I arrived separately to dinner, but neither Danae nor Galen appeared for the meal. Calix took my hand as soon as I sat, kissing it, smiling at me.
"How is your day of labor, my love?"
he asked. I smiled back, though it didn't feel as real as I wished. "Difficult," I said. "There was much work to be done, but they all took to it. We fed everyone who needed food."
"Fantastic," he said. "Quite an endearing display."
I nodded. "Your people love you, Calix," I told him. His smile grew thin.
"And yet this resistance continues. They rebel. They don't trust my rule."
"No," I assured him. "It's just difficult to look past the hungry belly." His thumb pushed over my fingers.
"Hmm,"
he said, looking forward.
"This worked well, but the more ideas you have, the more I will think you are displeased with my reign."
And there it was, the reproach I had been waiting for since the day began. I walked along the edge of a knife with him, balancing between being a queen and a traitor. I squeezed his hand. "Never, my king." But no matter what he said, my actions at the mill were real. I was helping and changing things for the fate of our people. This was the road to peace, without bloodshed or death. And his words could not chase that from my heart. That night, I woke with a gasp to darkness.
"Enter,"
Calix called, and I twisted, realizing it was still night and there must be someone at the door. A jarring flare of light burst into the room as a guard entered our chamber with a torch in hand. I scrambled to cover myself, and Calix snarled,
"Turn away,"
to the offending guard. The man spun before he could even take a full breath. And Calix moved from the bed, finding my coat and handing it to me. I slid into it, clutching it closed. What is going on? I asked him.
Report,
Calix snapped, scowling as he found his own clothing.
The Quesitori sent urgent word for you, my king,
the guard said.
Bring it to me, he said.
And the guard came closer, holding out a folded page. Calix took it, opening it, and reading the contents while the guard stood there.
Guards!
Calix shouted. Theron appeared in the doorway, bowing, awaiting orders.
Make ready to leave within the hour. Notify my council as well.
Calix glanced at me, and then at the guard with the torch.
And gouge out his eyes. My king!
He pleaded. I looked to Calix, confused. Surely Calix couldn't mean...
Be grateful I don't demand your life for defiling the queen,
Calix said.
You are dismissed.
The guard ran out of the room, and Theron grimly watched him go before leaving as well, closing the door. Calix, I begged, getting out of bed. Calix, please, you cannot take that man's eyes. I am not defiled. He didn't harm me in any way. My coat had parted, and he stopped and stared at me, and the narrow piece of flesh exposed by the gap. He shook his head slowly.
No man could see you in such a state and not covet you, my love. It was a mistake not to kill him, but you make me lenient.
But you called him into the room. Calix's eyes narrowed.
And did I also tell him to stare upon your naked body? No. You would have him stare at you? Wasn't it you who said that a desert man would never let another covet his wife?
He stepped closer to me, sliding his hands under the coat.
You cannot question me like this, Shalia. I am your king, and though I am pleased you waited until we were alone to do it, it needs to stop. Do you understand me?
I shivered, casting my eyes down from his hard gaze. Where are you going? I asked.
South,
he said, drawing away from me and pulling his clothing on.
My Quesitori believe they have a breakthrough.
What do you mean?
They think they can recreate the elixir,
he told me.
I must go see the results immediately.
My heart jumped. I will come with you.
No,
he said sternly. Calix, I insisted. You have trusted me with this from the beginning. Why would you not do so now?
It is gruesome work,
he told me, his eyes narrowing. I came closer to him. My place is by your side, I said. His hands caught me, pulling me to him.
What of the mills?
He asked. The mills will run in my absence. I will have Adria see it done. His mouth was hard, but he nodded.
Very well.
In less than an hour, and well before the light of day, we were led through the halls of the castle, coming out into the cool dark of the courtyard.
What is the meaning of this?
Calix grunted. I peered around him to see Kairos on the walkway, turning to smile at us.
Good morning. What are you doing here?
He shrugged.
Seemed like an excellent time for a walk. Where are you two off to?
The south, I said, and Calix squeezed my hand hard.
It's business of state,
Calix snapped.
You can either remain here or return to the desert, but you cannot accompany us.
Kairos grinned.
Surely if it's safe enough for my sister, it's safe enough for me.
Kairos, I said, stepping in front of my husband and meeting Kairos's eyes. The king said you cannot come. His eyes searched my face.
Very well,
he said.
Watch the skies, little sister.
He kissed my cheek, sliding past me. I watched him go before Calix hurried me along, and it took several long minutes to realize that Osmost was not on his shoulder.
Did you tell him we were leaving?
Calix demanded. No, I said, turning to my husband.
Your brother is outlasting his welcome,
he told me gruffly.
He brought me to the carriage that was waiting for us and offered his hand to help me inside. I sat on one cushioned bench, and a moment later he sat beside me in the darkness, his arms sliding around my tense shoulders. I sat forward, then his arm fell away from me.
"Wife?"
he asked. "It means a great deal to me that Kairos is here. You know that. You don't need to threaten him." He shifted a little.
"I did not threaten him."
"Outlasting his welcome?" I repeated. You just gouged out the eyes of a man for less."
"I'm sure his eyes haven't been gouged out just yet."
I shook my head, though it was dark enough that he couldn't see. "I cannot watch you be so casually cruel with an easy heart, Calix. I can't." There was a long silence in which I could feel my heart beating, the risk of displeasing my husband rushing in my veins. Then he sighed heavily.
"He can stay a little longer,"
he allowed. I felt his hand cover my stomach, his touch possessive, caging me.
"After all, hopefully he will be an uncle soon enough."
His lips brushed over my temple, his body curling around me.
"I'm not cruel, Shalia."
"You terrorize people," I whispered to him.
"Sometimes I have to,"
he said.
"A ruler cannot be emotional about life. Every day I have to choose a path that will save the most lives. But I will never be able to save every life. It is a terrible burden."
He was silent a long while.
"Is this just about the guard, Shalia?"
"Who did naming that guard protect?" I asked, avoiding his question, certain I did not want to confront him about his past and what I knew here in such an enclosed space.
"Him," Calix said. "I was protecting his life. Every time he glanced at you, I would see it in his eyes, his memory, his desire. And before long, he would force my hand. Men are animals of nature, my love. I could see his heart like I see my own."
I shook my head, anger making me resolute. "Perhaps that has made you a good king, Calix, but I cannot think such ruthlessness will make you a good father."
"The only ruthlessness my children will ever see is the swift death of anyone who tries to hurt them. Or you."
His hand tightened on my stomach, gripping me until I made the noise, and he sucked in a breath.
"Forgive me, my sweet. Forgive me,"
he murmured, close to my ear, his fingers skimming over me.
"The thought. I don't know what I would do if I were to fail as a father. The thought chills me. But I have to trust that this is your purpose, to show me what it means to love, so that I can love our children. I can't wait for the day you carry my child, Shalia. It is my every hope."
"It is so very important to you," I whispered, looking toward him.
"A man is nothing, his legacy nothing, his lifetime nothing, until he has someone to continue on in his stead. All I achieve is useless without you."
Warmth curled around my heart as the carriage moved, rolling gently into motion to carry us south. "I want to have many children," I admitted to him. His mouth kissed my cheek, slipping closer to my lips, and it made the warmth travel to my bones.
"I will give them to you. I will give them all to you."
His fingers spread on my belly like he was willing life into being there. I covered his hand.
"A son to start,"
he whispered.
"My heir. I will grow him up in my image and teach him how to rule. And perhaps a little sister. Someone for him to protect and care for. A girl with your beautiful face. And then another girl. She'll be the mischievous one."
I leaned my head on his shoulder, touching his fingers on my stomach, wanting to believe this man was more real than the vengeful ruler who blinded a guard for a moment's mistake. The warmth of his hand was soothing.
Will she?
I asked. We'll have to watch out for her.
Zeno will watch out for her,
he said.
Zeno?
Our son,
he said.
And then we'll need another boy. Zeno will need someone to command the armies.
Was it so with you? I asked. Did you three know the roles you would play at birth?
Mostly,
he said.
I would be king, of course. For Galen, he could either vie for the military or the Trivati, a religious appointment.
And the Nei?
She is the hidden face,
he said.
She has always been unpredictable.
And did your father teach you in such a way?
He was silent for a long while, and I was about to speak, say something else.
There is another piece of the vision,
he told me softly.
The one that foretold my death. There was a book full of his visions that was discovered after his death. In it, he said I would not see my first child born into this world.
I tried to pull back from him, but he held me tight. What? I asked. Why didn't you tell me that before?
It's not true,
he said softly.
It can't be. And you will be my way to prove that. We will have many children together. We have to.
What do you mean, we have to?
There was another stretch of quiet.
The Consilium of Vestai knows of this prophecy also. They trapped my father. Either we were the three-faced god incarnate, as he claimed, and I could thwart such a prophecy, or we weren't. And that made him a liar, and our reign invalid. If I don't pass my crown on to a son or daughter, it will fall to the Consilium. And I can't imagine they'll allow my siblings to survive such a shift in power.
I gripped his hand. Do Galen and the Nei know of this?
Yes,
he said softly. Pale light peeked into the carriage, and the gray haze lit his face enough for me to see deep worry etched there. We'll have many children, Calix. I promise.
Then he drew me closer, holding my hand on his heart.
You are my salvation, Shalia,
he whispered to me.
Watch the skies. It was a short carriage ride to an ocean port. The sky was dark, full of ropey, bulbous clouds that were barely catching the light of the coming dawn. And the wind was picking up as guards ushered us down a long wooden pier. Theron walked in front of me, getting into what I assumed was a boat, despite never having been near a body of water larger than the lake at Jitra until recently. It was long and wide and staffed with men at oars. I hesitated at the edge of the pier, glancing at Calix, but he was speaking to a guard. Unsure, I looked back to Theron, and he nodded sharply, holding out his hands. Sucking in a breath, I put my hands in his.
"Jump here,"
he said, tapping a raised board with his feet. I closed my eyes and obeyed. My feet hit something solid, and I wobbled, my knees going weak, but Theron held me until I was steady and opened my eyes. He smirked at me.
"Well done, my queen."
I huffed at him, but he pointed me forward, and I pried my fingers away from him slowly. The boat was a living thing. It rocked under my feet, and I gasped, tipping forward to find something to grab onto. Theron came to me, offering his arm, and I gripped it.
"Sit, my queen,"
he said, pointing to some kind of narrow wooden bench in the center. I nodded, sinking down. My husband stepped on the boat, and it pitched again, and I yelped, gripping the wood. Calix sat beside me, chuckling.
"We must work on your sea legs, wife,"
he said, patting my knee. The wind blew through me, but I couldn't figure out how to hug my coat tight around me and hold on to the bench at the same time. I shivered, but I refused to let go of the bench. Theron sat on the left side of me, and he blocked some of the wind, but
But then the oarsmen pushed away from the pier, and the boat lurched again with the effort. I kept from crying out, but fear shot through me, and I found my fingers on the bench shaking with the effort to hold on. Calix stood, shifting the boat again, moving closer to the pointed front of it. I could feel Theron's eyes on me, but I couldn't even look at him. He coughed.
"The boat is very safe, my queen," he said.
He spread his hands, explaining.
"It's a wide, low boat. It means it's difficult to tip over."
I managed to nod.
"We will only be on the water for a few hours," he said. "This is the fastest way to Liatos, the southernmost of the Bone Islands."
I shivered at the thought, and a fierce wind rushed under my clothes.
"Let me see if I can find something warmer in your things," he told me, standing.
He moved, and I shuddered at the rocking of the boat and the sharp gust of wind. My husband sat down again beside me, and I clutched his arm.
"Oh, my sweet,"
he chuckled.
"The ocean is nothing to be frightened of. We have conquered it the same way we have conquered the land." "You," he said, shouting at Theron, his voice close to my ear. "Sit! You are disturbing the queen."
Theron scowled, but obeyed before he could find me something warmer. I shivered, and Calix put his arm around me. It was warm and comforting, and as the boat rocked and moved, I wondered if this was what marriage was meant to be, slowly finding ways to need each other and comfort each other. Perhaps this was how it had been for my parents at the start. Perhaps love was something that grew, not something that was determined by who removed my veil. But then I thought of the man who even now was probably having his eyes taken away. I was capable of caring about Calix. I knew that was true. I could live with him, and I would love our children with every bit of my heart. But as I shuddered against the cold, I sent a dark wish out over the sea that I would never grow to love my husband.
The skies grew dangerous with heavy rain-filled clouds as a new shore came into sight. Even the smudge on the horizon was an incredible relief to me. Calix stood, going to the front again and shouting orders at the oarsmen. Two rocky jetties came out into the ocean, curling around the harbor to allow for only a narrow passage that no more than a single boat could go through at a time. The rock walls were thick and rough, with huge columns jutting above them to support the narrow ledge. I could see guards walking the length of it, illuminated along the way with bowls full of fire. And at uneven intervals, I saw something trailing from the ledge, swaying in the wind like a banner. As the boat slid through the narrow passage, I saw that the banners were bodies. I gasped, covering my mouth, looking at Theron. He leaned closer to me.
"Punishment," he said, "for disobedience in the communes."
There must have been 30 bodies hanging along the length of the wall. From what I could see, some had been there for a very long time. In some places, there was an empty rope moving in the breeze. And I imagined there had been bodies there, swinging until the wind broke the ropes and let them fall onto the rocks. I stared as long as I could. It felt like the only way to honor them. The oarsmen brought us deep into the wide harbor. It looked like a bustling city. There were many ships in the harbor, more still at a complicated network of floating piers and docks. The boat brought us swiftly to a dock with no other boats on it. Soldiers were flooding down the planks, and they all fell into place at the precise moment that the boat sidled up alongside the dock. Calix made a gesture that I thought meant for me to stand, and I did, on stiff and shaky legs. Calix moved with confidence, stepping on the side of the boat and grabbing a soldier's hand to jump onto the dock. The boat pitched hard, and I yelped, my legs twisting weakly underneath me. Theron caught me, pushing me up off the boat and into Calix's arms. The motion was too much, and I gripped his arm for a long moment, trying to steady myself. Even though I could see the dock was still and unmoving, I felt like the ground was shifting and rocking beneath me.
You will be unsteady for a while.
Come, Calix said, tucking my hand in his arm, leading me down the walkway with a tug. My legs were weak and watery, and I found myself clinging to his arm, and my husband never looked so pleased. The army led us to a horse, which I mounted to sit in front of Calix, and as we rode slowly through the city, I saw the people first. There were long lines of men, walking in slow, even paces, like a ghostly version of the soldiers' march. These men wore torn clothes that all had a chalky white on them. They were emaciated, their bodies looking bent and stooped, if not entirely broken, and they were marching down into the ground. When the road turned again, I saw where they went. The ground was hollowed out, hundreds of feet deep, a stone cavern that was filled with men and the unfinished bones of a huge warship. A crack and a boom sounded, so loud I jumped. But no one else reacted. Everyone just kept on working, blind to the others around them. And I wondered if nothing had actually happened, or if it simply didn't matter.
We have the best shipbuilders in the world,
Calix told me, his voice in my ear.
Our workers have unparalleled skill and dedication. The results are extraordinary.
I nodded, struck mute by the sight of it. As the road turned again, I could see two more stone caverns, and yet somehow my eyes caught on a pair of very worn men's shoes, askew and abandoned by the side of the road. The city was laid out in a tight, confined grid. It seemed that there were enclosures. Their walls high and impenetrable, and around each large enclosure were spaces where only the soldiers could go. Above it all, I saw a tall tower, and Calix went on straight, heading toward the hill above the flat area extending out from the bay. There was a grand palace set in the hills, white stone like the Tri-City, but low and wide, with looming white gates that stood open for our approach. Calix rode slowly through the guarded gates and into a wide expanse of garden that stood before the palace itself, full of archways and breezy courtyards. He called a servant over and helped me down into the man's arms before dismounting behind me.
"Welcome to the Summer Palace, my love,"
he told me.
"This was a favorite retreat of my mother's, and the current home of the Caesatori's inquest."
A man in a long black coat came out and bowed, which made his hair flop over his face.
"My king, welcome. My queen, we have much to show you."
"Excellent,"
Calix said, his arm around my back.
"There is no time to lose. Show us your work, Caesator."
The man bowed again and then turned, leading us into the palace as his coat flapped out behind him. He led us through a long room paneled with ornate wood and into a room that must have been at one point a grand reception chamber. It shone, panels of metal and mirrors lining the walls to make the whole place glitter. There were two chairs set in the center and in front of them a table with liquids and glass containers upon it. Calix's arm left me the moment we neared the table.
"Is this it?"
he asked, picking up a glass bowl and a liquid so dark red it looked black until the liquid moved. It looked like blood.
"No,"
the Caesator said, going to a stoppered glass bottle.
"This is."
This liquid was dark green, and Calix frowned.
"It didn't look like this the first time. In my experience, we can never replicate nature's exact formula,"
he said.
"Something is always different, even in a small measure, but the result is the same."
Calix nodded sharply.
"Show me."
He took my hand, kissing it and drawing me over to the chairs. I sat beside him, holding on to his hand, nervous as the Caesator walked out of the room.
When he returned, it was with 3 guards, 2 women, and a young man, and my eyes jumped to Calix, but he was impassive. They looked tortured,